In the last two sermons, we began to read about the life of David. We saw that he grew up in a society accustomed to war, that he and all of Israel and Judah had adopted the thinking of the ancient Israelites when they came out of Egypt, that they had to fight in war instead of trusting completely in God to let him do all the fighting for them. Now, David was a man after God's own heart. And generally speaking, he didn't fight because he didn't trust in God. It is just that he, having grown up in a warring nation, never questioned whether it was right or wrong to do so. And so it is for many of us in God's church today. We might still do or believe in things which are not right in God's eyes, but we just never sat down to analyze carefully what we are doing, why we are doing the things we are doing, what we are thinking, what we are believing, and why. We saw that David showed, or that God showed David very slowly, through step-by-step experiences, if you please, that war only leads to more war. When we take the sword, we shall perish by the sword. We have seen that when David pursued the Philistines so that they had to flee from him, King Saul tried to kill him right then so that he had to flee from Saul. We've seen that David lied to the priest when he told him that he was on a secret mission for Saul, and the priest gave him bread for him and his men, and these men were apparently not with him right there but somewhere nearby, and he gave him the sword of Goliath, and that was a contributing factor for Saul to become suspicious and to kill the priest and all his sons but one. When David heard that, he realized that he had caused the death of the priest and his family. We read that he attacked the Philistines, we have read that, to save the city of Keilah. But then he found out from God that the citizens of Keilah would deliver him to King Saul, so he had to flee from Saul. But we also find that at that point God intervened and King Saul could not pursue him any longer for a while. When David tried to avenge himself against the fool Nabal, his wife Abigail intervened to keep him from bloodshed. Again, God stepped in and took care of the matter through Abigail. Nabal died, and then David married Abigail. And we have also seen so far that when David avoided war and pursued the way of peace, even toward his personal enemies, including King Saul, including Nabal, God intervened. God blessed David. But when he pursued the way of war, then many times tragic results were the consequence, because the law of the sword is an automatic law. You take it, you'll die by it, unless you repent. Now, God can always intervene. God can always nullify the effect of that law, and sometimes he does, when he sees true repentance, when he sees true remorse on our part, but sometimes he doesn't, at least not right away, in order to teach us valuable lessons. And so let's pick up the story now in 1 Samuel 26, where we left off last time. And this is now right after the episode with Abigail and Nabal. And now in 1 Samuel, verse 26, we find another interesting episode regarding David and King Saul. And to introduce this passage, it seems that this passage is trying to indicate to us that these things are happening because God wanted to see whether David would go on practicing the way of peace even without God's immediate intervention. You see, we had just read that God had to intervene by sending Abigail to stop David from avenging himself against Nabal. And so we read in 1 Samuel 26 and verse 2, "Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph." So he had as many chosen man with him as he had the first time when he tried to attack and to capture David. Now the question is, though, why did God allow Saul's attitude to change? Remember, Saul left David before, but now he comes back. And the reason is, God was testing David. And so we read as we go through the story that during one night, David and Abishai, now Abishai was the brother of Joab. And of course we are already have been introduced to Joab, and we will be talking about Joab and Abishai a little bit more later on. So this Abishai and David went into the camp where Saul was laying sleeping. And we read that Saul's spear stuck in the ground by his head. So now notice now in verse 7 of 1 Samuel 26. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp, with a spear stuck in the ground by his head, and Abner and the people lay all around him. Then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with a spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. You also notice in verse 12, at the very end of that verse, that they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. So God had his hand in this test. God allowed this test to be brought upon David for a reason, because the question was, what would David do? Would he kill Saul? It was an easy thing to do, humanly speaking. Would he kill him? Would he reward him evil with evil, as he at one time was trying to do with Nabal? And so we read 9 verse 9. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But please take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head, and let us go. So David and Abishai leave Saul, but they take the spear, the jug of water, which Brother Saul's hand had, to be able to prove that they would have been close enough to Saul to kill him if that's what David would have wanted to do. And then subsequently, David calls out to Saul's army from a great distance, pointing out that he could have killed Saul. And we notice that Saul's attitude changes, and that he confesses that he has sinned against David, his son. And so we, of course, he was his son-in-law. And so we read in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 26, then Saul knew David's voice, and said, is that your voice, my son David? And David said, it is my voice, O Lord, my Lord, O King. Verse 21. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly. And also in verse 25, then Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail. And so David went on his way. He didn't return to Saul, but he went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. But also notice not only Saul's reaction, but also notice what David said to him, beginning in verse 23. He said, may the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hands today. See, he understood that this was a test, that God had his hand here in the situation. The Lord delivered you into my hand today, he said, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, verse 24, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Notice the tremendous attitude of David, but also notice the realization of what was happening here. He could have killed Saul. He knew that wasn't what God wanted him to do. And as a consequence, now he is asking God to deliver him out of all tribulation because he acted the way he did. You see, sometimes God creates tests for us. And some have a problem with understanding that. How can God even do that? Now, God is not tempting us to sin, but God is testing us to see whether we sin, and he wants us not to sin. Remember, at the very beginning of the creation of man, God created the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as well as the tree of life. And he gave man a choice. And he says, don't take from the tree of the knowledge. Now, God had created it, but he said, don't take from it. But you take from the tree of life. So God wanted man to reject the evil and to accept the good. The same here, God gave a test to David. He prepared opportunities for him to do evil, but he didn't want to him to do that. He wanted him to resist it, to reject it, to choose the good. And that's what David did in this case. And when David decided not to kill his enemy, but rather to put his trust entirely into God, we read that Saul returns to his place. And when you keep your finger here and turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 27 and verse 4, you notice something else about Saul. In 1 Samuel 27 and verse 4 we read, and it was told that to Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. And you will not find that Saul ever tried to capture or kill David again until the day he died. Although David had passed this test, he still hadn't come to the understanding yet that it was wrong to kill regardless of whether it was Saul, Nabal, the Philistines, the Amalekites, or whoever. And the following events makes this very clear. And they also show in very drastic and dramatic terms how futile and how wrong war is. That it only breeds more war. Because let's pick up the story in 1 Samuel chapter 27. We read in 1 Samuel 27 and verse 2 that David arose and went over with the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maok, the king of Gath. Now, we were introduced to this Achish before. See, David had already fled to him before, but then he feigned to be a madman. Remember when he kind of tried to tell him he was, you know, out of his mind. And so then the advisors of this king said, well, why do you have this madman amongst us? We have madmen enough. Send him away. And so then, of course, David was sent away. Now, he goes back to him, obviously no longer pretending to be mad, and so he's accepted. But not only is he accepted, but in verse 6 we read that Achish gave him Ziklag that day, and therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day when this book was written. Before we go on, let's first of all take note of the fact who came to David. The fact that many warriors came to David while he dwelt in the land of the Philistines. Keep your finger here in 1 Samuel, because we'll come back to that. But look at the parallel account at 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 12. And we read in verses 1 and 2. In 1 Chronicles chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. Now these were the men who came to David at Ziklag, while he was still a fugitive from Saul, the son of Kish, and they were among the mighty men helpers in the war, armed with bows, using both the right hand and the left in hurling stones and shooting arrows with the bow, and they were of Benjamin, Saul's brethren. But not only did they come to him when he was in Ziklag, warriors already joined him when he was still in the stronghold. If you go to 1 Chronicles 12 and verse 8, you read in 1 Chronicles 12 and verse 8, some Gedites joined David at the stronghold in the wilderness. Mighty men of valor, men trained for battle, who could handle shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and were as swift as the gazelles on the mountains. And then we also read in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, in verse 16, then some of the sons of Benjamin and Judah came to David at the stronghold. Verse 17, and David went out to meet them and answered and said to them, if you have come peaceably to me to help me, my heart will be united with you. But if to betray me to my enemies, since there is no wrong in my hands, now he just said that after he had spared King Saul, may the God of our fathers look and bring judgments. And then the Spirit came upon Amasai, chief of the captains, and he said, we are yours, O David. We are on your side, O son of Jesse. Peace, peace to you, and peace to your helpers, for your God helps you. But did they fully understand what that meant? If God helps us, do we then help to help ourselves in areas where God says not to? He goes on to say here, so David received them and he made them captains of the troop. So again, you have these warrior people, if you please, who surrounded David, or you can put it this way, David surrounded himself with these kinds of people. So we see that David associated himself with warriors, with mighty men trained for battle. And one must wonder whether these people kept him from fully understanding for a while, at least, the futility of war. You know, it's interesting that later his son Solomon would give this advice to his son. Turn with me, please, to Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1. Let's start reading in verse 10. And let's never assume that it doesn't matter with whom we have contact, with whom we associate ourselves. Let's never assume that other people cannot influence us to think the way they do, to act the way they do. Solomon, most certainly, he went through this by being influenced, as we will see later, perhaps in this one, perhaps in the next, through his wives, the many he married, he shouldn't have. And they influenced him even turning away from God. You notice here in Proverbs 1 that it is Solomon who is telling his son this, beginning in verse 10. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, and whole like those who go down to the pits. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us have all one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their paths. For their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. See? Their own blood. You take the sword, you shall perish by it. They lurk secretly for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners. Go to Proverbs chapter 12, in verse 26, where we read this inspired statement. Proverbs chapter 12, beginning in verse 26, or let's just read verse 26. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. That is a timeless admonition. Something David should have perhaps followed more carefully too at times. We will read later. He admits it. He admits it. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. Also notice chapter 22 of the book of Proverbs. In verse 24 and verse 25. Proverbs 22 and verse 24. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go. And Joab and Abishai were very furious men, as we will see. Lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. And then also notice chapter 29. Well, let's go to chapter 25 first, chapter 25 and verse 5. It's also an interesting statement, especially for a king. In chapter 25 and verse 5, take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness. Now, we will see that David's throne is going to be established and was established in righteousness, but he nevertheless didn't always take away the wicked from before himself. And that's why he had to learn some lessons the hard way. Chapter 29 of the book of Proverbs and verse 12. If a ruler pays attention to lies, all his servants become wicked. Now again, it just shows how we have to be careful with whom we associate and whom we listen to. And finally, let's look at the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 15. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33. And again, a very timeless statement here in the New Testament. And Paul introduces it by saying, do not be deceived. So he is saying, well, you could be deceived if you're not careful. He says, do not be deceived. And now he's telling us in what way we shouldn't be deceived. He says, evil company corrupts good habits. Don't be deceived. That's what's going to happen. You are going around with evil people. Your good habits will be corrupted. Now, either we believe this or we don't, but this is what the Bible clearly tells us, warns us. And God warns us because he wants our good. He wants that we have a happy life, that we live happy lives. Now let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 27, because now notice what David and his men are doing. And you just wonder, I just have to wonder when I read this, was it partially because of the influence he received from those warriors he surrounded himself with? Because notice, 1 Samuel 27, beginning in verse 8. Verse 7, we just read that the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 full year and 4 months. Now beginning in verse 8. And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gizrites, the Amalekites, and I don't know what other kites he did. For those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. Whenever David attacked the lands, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, the apparel, and returned and came to Achish, that king of the Philistines. And then Achish would say, where have you made a raid today? And David would say, against the southern area of Judah, his own people. So he would tell Achish, oh, I fought against my own people. Judah. He didn't fight against Judah at all. But that's what he pretended, because he wanted to obviously be able to stay there against the southern area of Judah, he says, or against the southern area of the Yerameelites, or against the southern area of the Kenites. Now, I would have to assume that these were all enemies of the Philistines. That's why he said it. And David would save neither man nor woman alive, to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they should inform on us, saying, thus David did. So in other words, he killed them all, that there would not be any witnesses, that he could not be told upon that he in fact didn't, raid against those areas, but that he raided against those allies of the Philistines. And thus was his behavior all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines. You see, David added to the sin of killing the sin of lying. Because now he told this king Achish that he had fought against his own people, Judah, and against others who were apparently aligned and allies of the Philistines. Verse 12. So Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people Israel utterly abhor him, therefore he will be my servant forever. But we should know by now that this is not going to be without any consequence. And here is the consequence. Because of his deception, David was almost forced, if it hadn't been for God's intervention, to actually fight against his own people, to fight against Israel, to fight against King Saul. Because we read in 1 Samuel chapter 28, beginning in verse 1. 1 Samuel 28, beginning in verse 1. Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, "You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men." And David said to Achish, "Surely you know what your servant can do." And Achish said to David, "Therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever." But what happens now is that God, undoubtedly it was God, inspired certain princes of the Philistines to object to David's participation. We read beginning in chapter 29 of 1 Samuel and in verse 4. 1 Samuel 29 and verse 4. But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him, with this king of the Philistines. And so the princes of the Philistines said to him, "Make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him, and do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. Let me read this again. Lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s? And we also read in verse 9, Achish answered and said to David, "I know that you are as good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to the battle.'" You see, of course, David pretends when Achish tells him that he shouldn't fight, that, you know, why wouldn't you want me there, and what have I done to gain your mistrust? But you see how close a call that was. Because if you keep your finger here and go with me to 1 Chronicles chapter 12, in the parallel scripture, it tells you how close that call actually was for David. And he would have almost found himself in a situation where he had to fight his own people. 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and verse 19, we read. And some from Manasseh defected to David when he was going with the Philistines to battle against Saul. So he was already out there with the Philistine army to go and battle against Saul. It says, but they didn't help them, for the lords of the Philistines sent him away by agreement, saying, "He may defect to his master Saul and endanger our heads." Now maybe that's what David would have done. We don't know what he would have done in this situation. But you see how close a call that was. And what is interesting in this regard is the cause and effect relationship. Because you see, if David hadn't gone out to fight the Amalekites, he wouldn't have had to deceive the king, Achish, and Achish most likely wouldn't have had asked David to fight against Israel. So one sin, one problem led to the next, having some dire consequences, but frankly, a much more tragic and dramatic consequence of his war against Amalek was still awaiting him when he returned. And let's pick that story up in 1 Samuel 30, beginning in verse 1. 1 Samuel 30, and beginning in verse 1. It says, "Now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day." So the Philistine, the prince, said, "No, you go away from us." So he returned to Ziklag on the third day, arrived. That the Amalekites, you know, remember, he had fought the Amalekites before. And so while he was gone, the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag, and burned it with fire. And had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They didn't kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. Remember, David had killed the men and the women. The Amalekites took captive the women. And apparently also the men, it doesn't quite say, but probably not, but at least the women. Verse 3, and of course most of the men were gone anyway, with David. So verse 3, so David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire. And their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, notice by now he had Abigail, but he also had Ahinoam, whatever the name is there, of the Jezreelite, Tess, so at least he had two by that time. And we'll talk about Michal, the daughter of Saul, in a moment. So anyhow, these two wives, Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelites, had been taken captive. Verse 6. And now David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. Now notice that scenario. Let's look very soberly at this scenario, at the possible end result of a defeated warrior. His own people tried to stone him at that moment. But David does the right thing here. In verse 8, we read, no, in verse 6, let's look at the ending of verse 6. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. That's what he had to do. He had to strengthen himself in the Lord his God. And then we read that he inquired of God whether he should attack the Amalekites. And God answered in verse 6, no, in verse 8, so David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them, and without fall, without fail, recover all. Now, the question was asked recently, you know, how did David actually do that? In other words, how did he ask the Lord, and how did the Lord answer? Well, here we get a hint in verse 7. See, David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, apparently the only one who escaped, because Saul killed all the others, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. Now, the way this ephod functioned, it had all kinds of stones there, and they would light up in case the sun would, you know, somehow, make contact with the stones. And so a question would be asked, and then depending on what ephod, what stone would light up, that would be the answer God would give. And that was one way how David could find out the will of God. And God, of course, was heavily involved here and inspired this to happen. But anyhow, back to the story. We read that in verse 17, David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. Verse 18, so David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives, and nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything, which they had taken from them. David recovered it all. Now, of course, what we see here is that David, or rather God, fulfills the promise that he had made to David, because he had told him, well, you go ahead and attack them, and you will be doing this without fail. You know, he would later say that in chapter 30 and in verse 22, when his men who had gone on this attack didn't want to share the spoil with those who hadn't gone on the attack. And look how they are being described here in this chapter, in 1 Samuel chapter 30 and verse 22. It says, then all the wicked and worthless men are those who went with David. So he surrounded himself with wicked and worthless men. That's a point we've got to keep in mind. So when they said to him, because they didn't go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Verse 23, but David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered us into our hands the troop that came against us. So David fully recognized God's power, God's protection. But we should also point out here again, so that we don't misread this passage. You see, God, quote-unquote, ordered David to attack the Amalekites because David had asked him whether he should. David never asked the question, the general question, the absolute question, is going to war right or wrong? He never asked that. He only asked the question, should I fight this battle? Will you be with me in this battle? Of course, God simply saw to it that his will and purpose was accomplished. And remember what God had already prophesied way back when, at the time of the book of Exodus, when it came to the Amalekites. Let's keep our finger here in 1 Samuel, and let's go back to Exodus chapter 17, and notice what God had already said about the Amalekites. And since David was a quote-unquote willing instrument, far too willing to fight in war, God used him. But that didn't make his war right. That didn't make war right. Notice Exodus chapter 17, beginning in verse 14. The Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book, and account in the hearing of Joshua that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, The Lord is my banner, for he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And then there are other scriptures which point this out, because, again, it had to do with the fact how the Amalekites attacked Israel when Israel was worn out, and they would go after mainly the young people and would wipe them out. Notice Numbers chapter 14. Numbers chapter 14. In verse 41, here's an example where God didn't go out with the army of Israel to fight Amalek, because there they had done something which God didn't accept. So it was only when God was with them that they would be successful. But notice in Numbers 14 and verse 41, Moses said, now why do you transgress the command of the Lord, for this will not succeed? Do not go up, lest you be defeated by your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and you shall fall by the sword, because you have turned away from the Lord will be not with you. But they presumed to go up to the mountaintop. And nevertheless, neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed from the camp. Verse 45, and the Amalekites and the Canaanites who dwelt in that mountain came down and attacked them and drove them back as far as Hormah. In David's case, David asked God for help. He asked him specifically, should I attack? And God said, go ahead. Now, in that regard, he was in harmony with God, but not in the fact and to the extent that he actually wanted to fight that war. And God said, yeah, this is great. Let's go and fight in a war. See, David never asked that question. And we'll talk about this in a moment. I hope we can get to it today. Because it was the same as was his war with the Philistines when he saved the city of Keilah. In 1 Samuel 23, as we talked about it last time. You know, David wanted to fight. He was just wondering, should I fight this battle? He wasn't asking the question, should I fight in war, period? Or should I leave all the fighting to you? And again, subsequent events here in 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel prove that. Because in 1 Samuel chapter 31 and in verse 2, we read now what happens. While David was fighting the Amalekites. While this was going on, the Philistines fought against Israel. And they killed Jonathan, the son of Saul. In 1 Samuel 31 and verse 2 we read, then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and some other of Saul's sons. Of course, Jonathan, the very close friend to David, was killed in that battle, while David was fighting with the Amalekites. And we read in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and in verse 1. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, so Saul was killed in that battle as well, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag, that an Amalekite, now notice this, here he was fighting and slaughtering the Amalekites. And now an Amalekite comes to David. We read this in verse 8 of 2 Samuel 1. That this person who reports now to David that King Saul died was an Amalekite. Because in verse 8 of 2 Samuel 1, we read, David said to, and he said to me, in other words, this is Saul asking, he's relating the incident now when Saul died. So he says, now Saul said to me, who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. And so now this Amalekite tells David in verse 10 his side of the story. So he says in verse 10, so I stood over him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. So in other words, he said Saul was wounded, so I killed him. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them here to my lord. Now, if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 31, it is not entirely clear what actually happened here. Because in 1 Samuel chapter 31 and in verses 4 and 5, the report saying here that it was Saul's armor bearer who actually killed Saul. Now, we don't know exactly what part the Amalekite had in the killing of Saul. But what is interesting here is that David believed that report. And so we see in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and in verse 13, then David said to that young man who told him, where are you from? And he answered, I am the son of an alien in Amalekite. So David said to him, how was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And then David called one of the young men and said, go near and execute him. And he struck him so that he died. So David said to him, your blood is on your own hands, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. So what is interesting in the story now is that David had to realize that while he was out there slaughtering the Amalekites, an Amalekite had killed King Saul. And we read that David grieved very much over the death of Saul and Jonathan. And we read in verse 12 of the same chapter, chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, and they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And then also, of course, beginning in verse 17, the whole entire song is being composed and prepared and written regarding Israel's defeat in battle. It's very interesting how the song ends in verse 27 of chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. You know, the weapons of war should perish through peaceful means, but that wasn't the time yet, was it? Here, the weapons of war perished temporarily through war. And we should know by now that war only breeds more war. And as we go on with the story, that is exactly what we will encounter. Now, the following events which took place here, I just want to briefly summarize, because they didn't affect David directly, but they did affect him indirectly, in that he could observe what was happening, and in that he could take some important lessons from it. And very briefly now, David had been anointed king over Judah. But Abner, who was the commander of Saul's army, we read in 2 Samuel chapter 2 and in verse 4, he took, and also verses 8 to 9, he took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and he made him king over all Israel. But let's quickly read this, because I want to point out one other thing here. In 2 Samuel 2 and verse 4, we read, then the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Now notice this. They anointed him king over the house of Judah. This is long before the separation of Israel and Judah took place under King Solomon's son. Here already we see a distinction between Judah and Israel. You notice this here. David was made king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, the men of Jabesh Gilead were the ones who buried Saul. Verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and over all Israel. So now you had, if you please, the house of Israel already here, and the house of Judah already separated. Now, they will be uniting under David and under Solomon, but then they will be separating again, as we know, under King Solomon's son. But going forward with the story now, Abner and Joab, and of course Joab, by the way, I don't know whether I mentioned that, Joab was the son of David's sister. So that's why they were also closely related from a bloodline. So Joab was the son of David's sister. So Abner and Joab led their armies then against each other. So they were fighting each other. And we read then that there was a fierce battle between them. So there was civil war going on between Israel and Judah. And so we find that fleeing Abner was pursued by Asahel. Now Asahel was another of Joab's brothers. And we read in verse 23 of 2 Samuel 2, however, he refused to turn aside, and therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the blunt end of the spear, so that the spear came out of his back, and he fell down there and died on the spot. And so it was that as many as came to the place where Asahel fell down and died stood still. And so we read then that Judah didn't cross pursuing Israel until in verse 26, Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the latter end? A timeless, correct statement. Do you not know that it will be bitter in the latter end? And how long will it be then until you tell the people to return from pursuing their brethren? And Joab said in verse 27, as God lives, unless you had spoken, surely then by morning all the people would have given up pursuing their brethren. And so Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood still and did not pursue Israel anymore, nor did they fight anymore. So Israel then stopped the fighting against Judah that day. But nevertheless, we read in 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 1, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. So the war never stopped until much later. And we read then that David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And we see here again God's hand in this, because God was now accomplishing his will. He was fulfilling his prophecy which he had made. Because remember, he had taken the kingship away from Saul under Samuel already. Samuel had already told Saul that he is going to be, you know, taken the kingship away from and to be given to a man after God's own heart. And you see, we also read in 1 Samuel 15, that's something you may want to look at later, that Samuel said, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. David was better than Saul. No question about that. And so when Abner was apparently wrongfully accused by King Ishbosheth. Now here was Abner, the commander who was fighting for this king, but then he was accused to the king that he had slept with a concubine of the king, and it looks like that was an incorrect accusation. This Abner now decided to join forces with David. And so we read that in 2 Samuel chapter 3. And just to briefly summarize, he went with 20 men to David to discuss with him future steps and how to join the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And then we read that Abner departed in peace. But remember, it was Abner who had killed the brother of Joab. And Joab had been absent. He wasn't present when Abner visited the king. And so now we read in verse 21 of 2 Samuel chapter 3. Then Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. And so David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And at that moment the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. And when Joab and all the troops that there with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. And Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away, and he has already gone? Surely you realize that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know that all that you are doing. Now, of course, it wasn't true, but Joab had his ulterior motives. And when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know that. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Now we may notice here something. We may notice that Abner had struck Asahel in the stomach, and so Joab struck Abner in the stomach. And so Abner dies. Verse 28. And afterward, when David heard it, he said, "My kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge, is a leper, who leans on a staff, or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner, because he had killed their brother, Asahel, at Gibeon in the battle. But nevertheless, even though David fully understood this to be absolute blatant murder, he didn't punish Joab for this murder. Only shortly before he died, he gave instructions to Solomon to deal with Joab. Again, keep your finger here in 2 Samuel 3. Quickly turn with me, please, to 1 Kings chapter 2. And notice what David is telling Solomon here just prior to his death, what to do with Joab and why. 1 Kings 2, beginning in verse 5. He's telling Solomon, 1 Kings 2 and verse 5, "Moreover, you know also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner," we just read that, "and also to another one, Amasa," we haven't even read that yet, "whom he killed. And he shed the blood of war in peacetime, and put the blood of war on his belt that was around his waist, and on his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore do according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace." But why didn't David do it himself? Well, let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 3, and let's look at verse 39. That's what he's saying. "I am weak today, though I am anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah," in other words, Joab and his brother, "they are too harsh for me." In other words, he said, "I can't do it. I don't have the power, the strength, the might to do it. I can't deal with these guys." And of course, they kept influencing David, not to his good, as we go through the story. He goes on to say, "The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." So to summarize what we have read so far, David saw, or could have seen, as Abner pointed out, it will be bitter. Let me repeat this. It will be bitter in the latter end, and the sword devours forever. He could have observed, and did, that bloodshed leads only to bloodshed. And we also note that David still associates himself with people who were too harsh for him, as he himself said, who clearly believed in war, who showed through their actions that they believed in war, that they didn't refrain themselves from even murdering somebody, quote-unquote, in peacetime. And they certainly had an influence on David. Now let me read 2 Samuel 3 and verse 14, a passage which I have not read yet, because it's an interesting one and leads me to another topic I'd like to briefly discuss now. In 2 Samuel 3 and verse 14, we read that David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife." Of course, I have always a problem pronouncing this correctly. Michal. It's not Michael, but Michal, maybe. "Whom I betrossed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." Now you remember that story, how Saul told him, "Well, you kill 100 Philistines and then you can become my son-in-law." And David went out and he killed 200 Philistines. But it's interesting that he is saying here in this verse that he really had to only kill 100. You realize that. Because that was the price he had to pay to Saul. Of course, Saul hoped that he would die in the process. But it's interesting here that David calls Michal his wife. Now, we know that she was once his wife. If you keep your finger here, let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 25. Let's quickly review this passage. In 1 Samuel chapter 25, and we read in verse 44, that after David fled from Saul, Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. So Saul took Michal, who was at that time David's wife, and gave her to this Palti. But it's interesting now, when you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 3, when David tells this Ishbosheth to give him back Michal, and he calls her my wife, let's notice how the Bible calls her. In the next very verse, in verse 15, and Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. So the Bible now calls Michal the wife of Paltiel, her husband. And the reason is that under the law, which was in force and effect at the time, David was not supposed to take her back after she had become the wife of another. The Bible clearly prohibited that. But David probably did it for political reasons. So he could say that he was now the husband of King Saul's daughter. But we find later in 2 Samuel 20 and verse 3, a passage we'll probably read next time, that after his son Absalom had slept with his concubines, who were also called his wives, that David refused to sleep with them any further, treating them as widows. Because he understood that law, that once your wife leaves you or is taken away from you and sleeps with another, you're not supposed to take her back under that Old Testament law, which was in effect. And so now we read that after Ishbosheth, that son of Saul, is murdered, and we read that in chapter 4, and the murderers are executed by David, again in chapter 4, as is talked about, that now David becomes king over Israel and Judah. And that, again, is very interesting. Let's read it in 2 Samuel chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. Again, showing even here, again, the distinction between Israel and Judah. Now, people today don't understand at all that the Jews are not the entirety of Israel or the house of Israel. It's just one tribe. You know, later on, the Levites and the Benjaminites, at least part of them, joined them. And that's what we have today, looking upon as the Jews and all the other tribes of the modern house of Israel someplace else. And why do we see the distinction here in 2 Samuel 5, beginning in verse 1? Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel. Therefore all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old. Now notice this. He was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. But he was anointed king by Samuel when he was about 17. That's how long he had to wait in order to finally enter into the promise God had made him. A lesson for us. Sometimes it takes a while until God fulfills the promises he has given us. So he was 30 years when he began to reign. Verse 5, in Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So again, a clear distinction is made between Israel and Judah. And so notice in 2 Samuel 5, in verses 6 and 7, we read how Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, is being taken by David. Verse 6, and the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David, saying, you shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you, thinking David cannot come in here. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. So now he conquered Jerusalem, and now Jerusalem became known as the city of David, the capital of the combined house of Israel and Judah. Now again, keep your finger here in 2 Samuel and quickly turn with me to 1 Chronicles chapter 11, because it gives a little bit more background as to how Jerusalem was actually captured and through whom. 1 Chronicles chapter 11 and verse 6. David said, "Whoever attacks the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain." And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first and became chief. So in other words, now he became the commander of the army, so to speak, under David, because it was him who actually did conquer Jerusalem. But now let's go back to 2 Samuel 5, because again, a scripture I haven't read, which goes hand in hand with what I said about Michal to an extent. In 2 Samuel 5, beginning in verse 12, we read that David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And verse 13, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he had come from Hebron, and also more sons and daughters were born to David. Notice, more wives than the ones which were already mentioned, those two we had already read about. So he took more wives and concubines. So the question is then, how could he do that? Wasn't that against the law? Or did the Old Testament allow polygamy? Did God intend that a man should have more than one wife? As we will see, God never promoted polygamy, not even in the Old Testament. And many times, that's the sermon all by itself, when a man took more than one wife, curses and punishments were the consequence. You see, Abraham sinned when he slept with Sarah's maid, Hagar. Now, that wasn't only a sin because he lacked faith in God, because God had promised him a son, and of course he thought he had to kind of help God by using Hagar, because Sarah was barren at the time. And of course, that was lack of faith in God, that God could fulfill a promise he had made. But it was also clearly adultery, because he was married to Sarah. And we read that Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham. Now, let's keep your finger here in 2 Samuel, and let's turn with me to Genesis chapter 16 and review that account. Because also here, there are some interesting statements made if we read the account very carefully. In Genesis 16 and verse 3, we read, "Then Sarai," as she was then called, "Abram's wife," of course later Sarai was called Sarah and Abram was called Abraham, so I'll just say then Sarah, Abraham's wife, "took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband," Abraham, "to be his wife, after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan." You see, that is what Sarah was trying to do. She was trying to give Hagar to be the wife of Abraham. That was her speaking. That wasn't what God and how God looked at it. Because you see, when God talks about Hagar, and when actually talks to Hagar, she only is referred to all the time consistently as Sarah's maid. Never as Abraham's wife. Notice this, Genesis 16 and verse 8. God said, after Hagar left and fled from Sarai, or Sarah, and he said, "Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from? And where are you going?" And she said, "Oh, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarah." Notice in Genesis chapter 21 and verse 13. Another promise which now God is making to Abraham regarding Hagar and her son Ishmael. It says, "Yet I will also make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, not of your wife, but of the bondwoman, because he is your seed. At the same time, when God speaks about Sarah, he consistently, even after the episode with Hagar, refers to her as Abraham's wife. Notice Genesis chapter 17 and verse 15. Genesis 17 and verse 15. Then God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name." Also in verse 19, then God said, "No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac." Then in chapter 18 and verse 9, Jesus, when the three angels came, of course, the two angels and Jesus Christ, and they appeared to Abraham, and then they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And so he said, "Here in the tent." And he said, that's now Christ speaking, "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And then even later on in chapter 20, when Abraham, again because of lack of faith, deceived the king and told him that Sarah was actually his sister and not his wife, notice how the Bible so reports that incident in chapter 20 and verse 2. "Now Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister." And then also in verse 7, when God appears to the king in a dream, he says, "Now therefore restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So we see clearly the distinction. God consistently talks about Sarah as Abraham's wife. He never talks about Hagar as Abraham's wife, because all what was happening here was a classic case of adultery, something Abraham shouldn't have done. You know, we find about Isaac that Isaac only had one wife. There's nothing in the Bible that Isaac had more than one wife. Isaac's only wife was Rebekah. But Rebekah was barren too. She couldn't produce offspring. Now notice what happened in Genesis chapter 25 and in verse 21. Isaac did not repeat the mistake of his father, I should say, Abraham. He waited on God to give him children through Rebekah, who was barren. And so we read in Genesis 25 and verse 21. "Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife, because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived." But when it comes to Jacob, we know that he took more than one wife. And not only that, he repeated the mistake of his grandfather, and he produced offspring through the maids of his wives. But you see, he was unconverted when he did it. His conversion apparently took place in Genesis chapter 32, as much as we can try to pinpoint it from the scripture, because in Genesis chapter 32, beginning in verse 22, that's the episode when he was wrestling with God, and when he prevailed. And when he said, even in verse 29 and verse 30, "I have seen God face to face." Now that reminds me somewhat of Job at the very end of the book when he says, "Now I have seen you face to face. Until now I have only heard of you by a hearsay." Now of course Jacob in that sense even saw God face to face quite literally, because he wrestled with apparently Jesus Christ. But that is apparently when his conversion occurs. Because when you go to chapter 33 and verse 20, right after this episode, and right after he met with Esau, he was of course afraid that Esau would have him have it, but apparently God intervened and made sure that Esau would not kill him or even do him any harm. Then it says in Genesis 33 and verse 20 that Jacob erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel. And your margin points out that the literal meaning is God, the God of Israel. Up until this point, Jacob never referred to God as his God. He always talked about the God of my father, the God of my father. That's the first time that he actually is saying, "This is my God, the God of Israel," showing again that now his conversion had begun. Now we know that Israel's first king, Saul, took more than one wife, and he thereby sins, following the practices of the pagans all around him. And we also now read that David had more than one wife. We read of Michal, of Abigail, of Ahionian, whatever the name was. Later we will read of Bathsheba. And apparently in this particular passage we are at here in 2 Samuel 5 and verse 12 and 13, he took more wives. And he also took concubines. And we later read in 2 Samuel 15 and verse 16 that at least 10 of those concubines he left behind when he was fleeing from Absalom. And there are even other indications that seem to show that David had even more than just those 10 concubines and wives. And by the way, those concubines, as I mentioned earlier, are referred to as wives. And you can clearly see that if you look at 2 Samuel 12, 11. Because this is something we are going to go into next time, but this is when Nathan the prophet came and told David that his wives would be, you know, mistreated publicly as he had done it secretly to Bathsheba and, of course, her husband. And, of course, what happened is that Absalom slept with the concubines publicly when he entered Jerusalem. But we see then that David followed the practice of Saul and of other kings to multiply wives against God's explicit commandments. Because we read, and you might want to look at this later, just for the lack of time, in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17 and verse 17, where God specifically says to the kings, don't multiply your wives. In other words, don't. Well, let's just quickly look at that. You might as well read it exactly the way it's worded. Deuteronomy 17 and verse 17. He is saying here, neither shall the king, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Direct command to the kings not to do it. But you see, David's son Solomon most certainly tops David in that regard. We read that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Makes 1,000. But they turned away his heart. Now you see, Solomon didn't have a heart like David had. David was a man after God's own heart. And even though David should not have taken all those wives, at least they were not able to turn him away from God. There's no indication ever that David engaged in pagan worship, what Solomon did. Solomon did, he first started to build pagan idols for his pagan wives. And then we even read that he started to worship those pagan gods himself. And of course in 1 Kings 11 and verse 6 you read that this was extremely evil in the sight of God. But again, back to the question, why was that a sin, what David did? Why was it a sin, what Abraham did? And what Jacob did? Was it prohibited? Was it something God never intended to happen, that a man should have more than one wife? Well, let's go to the New Testament. Let's turn to Mark chapter 10. And let's notice Christ's words beginning in verse 6. Mark 10 and verse 6. From the beginning of the creation, Christ says, God made them male and female. And for this reason, a man, he's not just talking about Adam, you see, because Adam, it goes on to say, a man shall leave his father and mother. See, Adam didn't have a father and a mother. I mean, he's talking about mankind in general. He's talking about the purpose of marriage. He's talking about how it was intended by God to be. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. It doesn't say his wives. It even goes on to say, and the two, it doesn't say the three, the four, the hundreds, or the thousands, the two shall become one flesh. So then they, see, the husband and the wife, are no longer two, not five, ten, hundred, or thousands, but one flesh. So we see here clearly, it says in verse 9, therefore what God has joined together, let no man separate. We clearly see that God's intent for marriage was a relationship between a man and a woman. The two are to become one flesh. We also read that human marriage is a symbol of the spiritual marriage between Christ and his church. And we read that in Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians chapter 5, and of course the symbolism is described beginning in verse 25, where it says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her." But then let's read starting in verse 31 to make very clear what Christ is talking about, or Paul here, inspired by Christ. "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife." It doesn't say his own wives. His own wife as himself. "And let the wife see that she," it doesn't say, and let the wives see that they respect their husband. No, it says, "and let the wife see that she respects her husband." It's always talked about in the singular. There's only room for two. And of course, we also read in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 7 that Christ will come to marry his wife, the church. And it says his wife has made herself ready. It doesn't say his wives have made themselves ready, because there is only one church. The church of God is a spiritual organism. It consists of all in whom God's Spirit dwells. It is one body. It's not several bodies. There might be several man-made organizations, understand that, but when it comes to the church, it is one body, a spiritual body, the body of Christ. It doesn't say the bodies of Christ. There's only one wife. And so this is a spiritual application to the physical marriage relationship between one husband and one wife. And so that is how God intended it from the outset. But man, through their customs, through their ideas, through their man-made rules and regulations, strayed away from that, as they strayed away from God's original intent that man shouldn't fight in war. And they adopted that, and later they adopted a king, although God said, "You sin when you do that." And then they also came up with ideas for divorce, where God said, "You know, I have put husband and wife together, and they shouldn't divorce." And of course, later on in the New Testament, there are very limited exceptions given. And finally, we read in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, and also in verse 12, that a minister or a deacon must only have one wife. Now, but we have read in other scriptures that this doesn't only apply to a minister and a deacon, because Paul, in the book of Ephesians, made it very clear it applies to all of us in the church. But Paul makes an additional point here. He's pointing out that if there is a minister or a deacon, or a person, I should say, who is coming in the church because he comes out of a society where polygamy is legally permitted and practiced, and that has happened in the early times, and it's happening even still today, Paul is making this very clear. He can't be ordained. Now, this doesn't mean that it's therefore all right for the others to have more than one wife, but Paul makes this very clear here when he talks about the qualifications of a minister or a deacon. Well, they can't be ordained. And I guess I will probably stop now. According to my watch, I've already spoken for an hour and 20 minutes about. So I think I'll stop here. And then next time in my final sermon on this topic, we will go in the revealing statements as what David did when he committed adultery, and also why he wasn't allowed to build the temple, and also why he sinned so greatly when he numbered the people. And we will see how all that relates to God's way of showing him that killing in war is wrong.